This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. After the death of a Transportation Security Administration officer at Orlando International Airport back in February, there's been renewed scrutiny on what some employees have described as a culture of bullying at the TSA. 36-year-old Robert Henry jumped from the balcony of a hotel inside the airport terminal. In a report from Spectrum News 13 that aired earlier this month, numerous current and former TSA agents described pervasive bullying and retaliation by management. Former TSA agents have also come forward to WMFE to tell their stories of a toxic workplace culture. In the background of these claims, the Department of Homeland Security released a report that found two of the six reasons for high attrition rates among TSA workers include, quote, management's competence, communication, promotion of negative work environment, disrespect, lack of trust, lack of appreciation or recognition, and unfair practices in appraisal, discipline, and advancement. The Union for TSA Workers is calling on the agency to end the pattern of bullying and retaliation, and congressional leaders are also looking into the TSA's workplace culture. WMFE is digging deeper into the story. We want to hear from current and former employees about what's really going on. We have a survey to complete over on our website at wmfe.org/TSA tips. That's wmfe.org/TSA tips. And a note, during this conversation, we will be talking about suicide. It's a sensitive subject and may not be suitable for all listeners. And if you or someone you know is showing warning signs of suicide, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 800-273-TALK. That's 800-273-8255. 90.7's Abe Abariah and Danielle Pryor have been following this story. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Darren Soto. He represents Florida's 9th Congressional District. He's on the House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology, which oversees aspects of the Department of Homeland Security. Congressman Soto, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thanks for the opportunity, Matthew.
And we're joined by Debbie Hanna. She's a union representative for TSA agents at Orlando International Airport. Debbie, thank you as well.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Well, this story started with the death of 36-year-old TSA agent Robert Henry back on February 2nd. Danielle Pryor, you were at the airport covering the story on the morning of the incident. What did you see and what happened?
I think the best way to kind of describe what it felt like inside the airport is to kind of play an interview that I did with Dalton Summers. He was one of the passengers who was waiting in the security line and kind of saw Robert Henry and his unfortunate death after he fell from the Hyatt Regency Hotel. So this is a clip of him. He was flying back to Columbus, Ohio at the time.
And I think that's the sound is what made everyone freak out. Because when we were there, they told everyone to duck, and then someone yelled bomb. And that was the crazy part, because then everyone just took off running. And the TSA agents pushed us through the terminals, and they sent us through. I was standing down at B. We were standing down at B for like 30 minutes.
So that's Dalton Summers, a passenger, recounting some of the chaos of that day on February 2nd. Danielle, this agent's death prompted an investigation. What has that investigation found so far?
So for right now, Jerry Henderson, who is the director of security at the Orlando International Airport, has been removed as a result of that investigation. Pete Garcia is the interim director in his place, but they're still investigating claims made by TSA agents about bullying and retaliation that they faced. And it's something that Rob Henry himself, who's the TSA agent who we were talking about before, had referenced.
And we'll get to that in a minute, but News 13 has done some reporting around that culture of bullying. What did we learn from their reports?
They found that dozens of TSA agents have made claims against administration, saying that, you know, if they filed any sort of claims against administrators, that they would be fired from positions, demoted from positions. In some cases, it would be, you know, retaliation to the point where they would be fired and they couldn't find any other work in Orlando or even in Sanford.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little more about the note that Robert Henry left behind.
Robert sent an email shortly before, and in the note he describes being bullied by managers. He had switched shifts and he had gone from an afternoon shift to a morning shift. He was having a hard time staying awake and keeping up, and he talked to his managers about this. And the response had been to basically bully him. People called him lurch and slow. for months before his suicide. He also talks about the fact that he'd put in a transfer because he wanted to go back to Dulles Airport so he could be with his family in Virginia, and that transfer had been denied, which is something we've heard from some of the whistleblowers we've spoken to as well.
Mm-hmm. So an indication as to just sort of what was going on in Robert Henry's life and, of course, sort of broader conditions there. I want to bring you into this conversation, Debbie Hanna. From the union's point of view, what kind of stories have you been hearing, and how long have you been hearing stories like this for?
This has been going on for years. I'd say a good 5 to 7 years that people have been reporting to both us and management that there was retaliation and intimidation and bullying. But when you report it to the management that's doing it, it doesn't go anywhere. And a lot of times our officers didn't want to report something that was going on because they were afraid of retaliation.
Mm-hmm. And just a note, so, too, we did reach out to TSA to invite them to join us for this discussion. They declined to join us for
yeah,
this
they
discussion.
Won't do that.
So what has been the recourse of the union up until now? What kind of action have you been able to take, and what might have changed with the renewed investigation, renewed scrutiny on what's going on at TSA now?
Well, we have been telling our officers not to be afraid and to report to us for a long time. But as I said, they were worried about retaliation. But after Officer Henry jumped to his death, got full attention of everybody everywhere, the investigation started, and the officers, because it was confidential, were willing to speak to people. I know supervisors spoke to investigators. I know managers spoke to investigators, and I know our officers did.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been filing EEO complaints. We've been filing grievances. We've been filing requests for reviews for years
mm-hmm.
on the things that go on there. And managers that have had multiple EEOs filed on them, Nothing is done.
Mm-hmm.
And it just continues. And then if they find out that, you know, and of course they will find out who's got an EEO against them, then, you know, it just goes from there. And if supervisors are friends, the supervisors, it's just a whole culture, toxic culture at TSA. And it's not just MCO. It just happens that we're in the spotlight right now.
Right. Well, Abe Abariah, 90.7's health reporter, I want to bring you in now. This is broader than just one incident, as we've heard from Debbie. What do we know about work conditions for TSA agents across the country?
Well, this is it's a very large agency. So if you look at this nationwide, it's more than 430 airports, more than 61,000 employees nationwide that work for the TSA. And the Office of Inspector General, which is under the Department of Homeland Security, has come out with a report that looks, you know, and they're looking at this issue through the lens of employee retention and attrition. So, you know, the TSA spends $75 million annually training and hiring people, and they have a very high turnover rate. It's about 17% turnover. And if you look at, they hire a lot of part-time employees, and about 1 in 4 part-time employees are leaving within the first 6 months. And when they actually go back through and they do these exit surveys with them, and they sort of, you know, collate all that data together, there are some trends.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when it comes to management, there are issues with promotion of a negative work environment was one, the impact of the job on the personal life. And then with senior leadership, there's respect issues, work environment, and one that really jumped out to me was unfair practices and appraisal, which definitely seems to hint at a larger problem of retaliation within the agency and what sort of authority and checks and balances there are between management and their employees at the TSA.
Mm-hmm. Abe Abariah, there is more to come, right? You're reaching out to see what other stories are out there and inviting some of those people with stories to come forward. Just tell us what the project is, what the plan is from here on out.
So we've built a survey online. So if you go to wmfe.org/TSA tips, that'll take you to a survey where you can contact us and you can provide some contact information. You can upload documents if you so wish. You can also not. You can leave it anonymously. So we're trying to give people a way to maybe give us some stories that you know, we obviously have to report out and be able to corroborate, but, you know, we might be able to get more stories this way. Mm-hmm. We also have an email as well, just tips@wmfe.org. We're asking people to, you know, share their stories, because when it comes to stories like this, you know, you need people to be able to come forward so that you can, you know, tell that broader story that, you know, all the evidence at this point is aiming at and pointing towards there being a broader story here. We just we don't know the extent of it yet. And that's what we're trying to get at.
What have we heard from TSA so far?
So they as you mentioned, they did decline to come on to the show. However, they did say that, you know, hiring and retaining qualified officers that, you know, protect the transportation system is a priority. And with in regards to this Inspector General report, there were 9 recommendations. TSA agreed with all 9 recommendations. So there's also sort of a you know, an understanding that there may be, you know, culture issues that may be contributing not only to, you know, with issues of bullying and harassment, retaliation, but also that sort of filter up to maybe costing taxpayers more money when it comes to hiring and training and retention and things like that.
Mm-hmm. So, and just a note too, we did reach out to the Office of Inspector General and they declined to come on the show as well. But I want to play a little bit of sound here. This is a congressional budget hearing last week. And when asked about a culture of bullying, this is what TSA Director David Pekowski had to say.
I think what's important is what the leadership emphasis is. And I published in a couple of documents. First one was the a new strategy for TSA that I published about a year ago. And one of the core values that we put into the TSA strategy was respect, because that was not a core value of the agency. And to me, that means respect for each other in the workplace, and also respect for passengers as they receive the services that we provide.
Well, that's TSA Director David Pekowski speaking at a congressional budget hearing last week. Congressman Darren Soto, listening to that from the TSA director there, what goes through your mind and how does it kind of tally with what we're hearing about the workplace environment for TSA employees and some of the situations they're in at this point in time?
Well, we certainly applaud putting in the word respect. That should have gone without saying. I think we all, as a basic understanding of cordiality between human beings, understand that that should be in every workplace environment. I do want to go back a little bit to talk about the setting in which this happened. You know, Robert Henry's suicide is a tragedy, and his last act was as a whistleblower to highlight the hostile work environment that's at TSA. And we're dealing with an airport that can be on multiple days a year the busiest airport in the nation. So you have this huge flux compared to other airports. Last year, there was an attempt based upon complaints with the Greater Orlando Aviation Authority to privatize the TSA. And we fought that as a local delegation and succeeded in getting dozens of new TSA officers. But even at that time, I was hearing problems, and Deb and others had mentioned it at AFGE. They weren't using step-up discipline. Every issue was a capital offense, and people were being attempted to be fired, and everything had to go to arbitration. As a result, though, we got dozens of new officers, and then a shutdown happened. Mm-hmm. And people were forced during the busiest season, the holiday season, to work without pay for an extended period of time, 40, 50 plus days. And I remember going each week and checking in with folks, and the morale was as low as I've ever seen it, even with the additional TSA employees. And so this is a tragedy upon a travesty, and that finally, when we get past the shutdown and we're working on these hostile work environment things, we see Robert Henry in an act of self-defiance and whistleblowing blew this whole thing wide open. And while it is sad that it took that much, now we're getting more public support to get the resources we need for TSA and our brave men and women who protect our airports every day.
Are you hearing more calls now in light of what's happened and you know, since February to look again at privatizing security at Orlando International?
No. One of the biggest things that stopped that going forward is we got a bunch of new TSA officers right after we stopped the privatization. TSA got the message. But at that time, we had heard from many folks there that they weren't using step-up disciplinary proceedings and that there was some hostile work environments. Now, we didn't know the extent of the name-calling and the ridicule, but you But there was a sense that after these big fights that we're trying to tackle, that there was more work to be done. But, I mean, we were just trying to keep the TSA agency here in Orlando and not have a private contractor when national security is on the line and no other major airport was doing that. And then having the shutdown on top of it, I mean, I was working on foods, bringing in food banks and working with local employers to help feed and clothe people and get them small loans while they were going through it.
So, right, and we saw plenty of examples of that across the country of people stepping up and offering some of that kind of assistance to federal employees throughout that shutdown.
And so to your question, there was a focus at that very moment. Literally, that's what ended the shutdown is people's flights being messed with because a bunch of folks in the airline industry, our union stepped up and said, no, we're not going to do this anymore. So I believe at that point, it entered the national consciousness how important these jobs are and that we need to have respect for folks. But I don't think there was this idea that they're being bullied on top of the already tragic shutdown issues that they were talking about. And now there's an ongoing investigation. Obviously, we saw Mr. Henderson's already been fired, and now we'll continue to get developments on that. And I'm also working with Deb and other folks at AFGE for a potential new anti-bullying bill. But it's a shame it has to come to that. These are things that should be basic parts of any agency. And to ignore these things from happening is why we have a situation like this. And oversight is a big part, asking these questions, putting folks on the spot. And I'm hopeful in the Homeland Security Committee they'll have – oversight hearing just on this incident and what we're seeing in bullying and TSA across the nation.
What would come next after that hearing?
Well, part of it is budget language to double down on demanding not only that folks who are bullying be taken, given more serious penalties, but also this idea of commensurate punishment. You know, everything can't be a major offense where people are fired.
Right.
That's what helps create this terrible environment. And that was something we were told about in December and had conversations with Mr. Henderson and others at that time. But, you know, at the end of the day, TSA is under Homeland Security, under the secretary and under the president. And so we could push, but they also have to push from the top down to make sure we're seeing these things happening. So if we really can push for oversight, we could push into the budget for things, we can show in the court of public opinion that these things are happening, but it's going to take some leadership by the new secretary and others to actually get these things done.
Debbie Hannah, with the union representing TSA employees at Orlando International, just back to you for a moment. Congressman Soto was talking about step-up discipline. Just explain for us what exactly that is.
So there's something called progressive discipline where you're supposed to start at the lowest form of discipline. So our lowest form is an interest-based discussion. But that's not what was happening. It goes from interest-based discussion to letter of counseling to letter of reprimand and can go to a suspension, which is one day up to 30 days. That's next. For a long time, they just skipped right over the interest-based discussion or the letter of counseling and automatically went to a letter of reprimand or worse, a suspension. Mm-hmm. For a minor offense, I mean, an officer would have an attendance issue. Okay, instead of sitting down and saying, what is going on with you? I've noticed, you know, you're having some issues here. Have you been sick? Are your children sick? Are you having problems at home? Whatever the issue is, they were like, okay, you're suspended 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
So now you have a 5-day suspension on your record, which can keep you from getting promoted or moving to a different location like Robert. And you have to go home and tell your family that you're doing 5 days without pay.
And if I may add, imagine being understaffed, overworked, not being paid, middle of the holiday season, and being threatened to have your job be taken away at any given time. And by the way, your main job is to keep our airport secure and the American public traveling in safety. And you can get an idea of what our TSA agents are dealing with over there.
Mm-hmm. So obviously a lot of issues kind of facing the TSA and at airports, whether it's Orlando or others. Abe, just back to you for a moment. How does this kind of tally with what you're learning about this issue and how widespread it may be?
Well, one of the things that also stood out to me in that Inspector General report was, and we haven't touched on it yet, was the issue of pay and, you know, how that impacts with retention and the workplace culture. You know, they mentioned that how at some of these airports, you know, you have workers who are able to leave the TSA and go work at, you know, a sandwich shop and make more money, which obviously is going to cause, you know, some of these issues. And the other thing that kind of strikes me about, you know, the broader issues with TSA that are brought out in this report versus what's happening at Orlando International, you know, a lot of the issues talked about are, you know, they discuss smaller airports and how you have a smaller staff and, you know, there are more turnover issues there, and that it seems to be less of an issue at bigger airports like Orlando International. And, mm-hmm. you know, here you have Orlando International, which, as the congressman pointed out, has gotten more TSA agents, is one of the largest airports in the country, and yet they are experiencing these staff issues as well. So, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of points to you know, top-down leadership or something else that's going on there that may be causing some of these issues.
Debbie, Hannah, how is it possible for contract negotiations to address some of these concerns that your members may be having?
I believe so. We're going into contract negotiations in June, but I would like to jump back for what he just said about losing people and having enough officers. Between October and the time that we had the shutdown, or not the shutdown, the privatization issue, and this past February, a year ago, mm-hmm. we had lost over 100 officers in that amount of time.
And what percentage of the workforce was that?
Well, we have 1,200 officers.
Right.
So, you know, they get in to be a federal employee, and then they see what's going on at MCO and how they're treated, and whatever the other issues are, they go to Customs and Border Patrol, where, you know, you can be making $70,000 in 4 years, and somebody who's been there 12 years, like I have, is making $42,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and where you go to ICE, a lot of it is the new folks that are coming in that we've spent all the time and energy to train and teach are leaving because of attendance issues.
Right.
Or because of the bullying or the intimidation. My problem with that whole thing is that, okay, we've brought you in, we've taught you all this stuff, we've taught you about, you know, IEDs and guns and how people sneak things through and whatever else, and now we're going to fire you?
Right, so that's something that definitely needs to be...
That's a disaster waiting to happen.
Right. In the final minutes we have here, Danielle, there's obviously some sensitivity when talking about an issue like suicide.
Absolutely.
For folks who are, you know, in strife, what's the best option here?
Yeah, if anybody listening to this is feeling depressed or apathetic or suicidal, or maybe has a friend or a family member who is, please reach out to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. You can call them right now at 1-800-273-8255. And if you prefer texting, you can reach out to the crisis text line. You can text 741-741.
Mm-hmm. Abe Abarai, just remind us to the next steps for your reporting, yours and Danielle's reporting on this project and where you're hoping to go with this and the survey again.
So I think we're at this point, we're in that gathering stage. We're looking to hear from as many people as we can. So, you know, we definitely are encouraging people at, like I said before, it's wmfe.org/TSA tips or tips@wmfe.org if you prefer an email. You know, it's, again, we're getting a lot of information already, a lot of documents from people, and we just want to keep going with that and sort of report out in the open and let people know this is something we're looking into. And, you know, it's an issue that we do take seriously.
Abe Abarai is 90.7's health reporter. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely.
Also joined by 90.7's Daniel Pryor. Daniel, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Congressman Darren Soto, thank you as well, Congressman.
Thanks for having me.
And Debbie Hanna, she is the union representative for TSA agents at Orlando International Airport. Debbie, thank you so much as well.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Still to come on Intersection, Time magazine has named Desmond Mead one of this year's 100 most influential people.
President Donald Trump, Michelle Obama, the Pope. Right? I'm on the list with the Pope. That was just a surreal feeling.
Mead's the driving force behind last year's Amendment 4, restoring the voting rights of Floridians convicted of a felony who've served their sentence. We'll talk to Mead about what it means to make the list and the work still ahead for his organization, the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the last couple of years, Desmond Mead has become the face of a movement to restore the voting rights of Floridians convicted of a felony once they've served their sentences. Last November, Mead celebrated as Floridians voted overwhelmingly to pass Amendment 4. Mead's the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. Now, Time magazine has named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world this year. Mead says he was floored to find his name on that list. Desmond Mead, congratulations.
Thank you, Matthew.
How does it feel to be on that list?
Wow, you know, it is, you know, I mean, it's amazing. When I first found out, you know, I was like floored. But when I woke up this morning and I seen who I was on the list with, you know, it seemed so surreal. You know, when you have President Donald Trump, Michelle Obama, the Pope, right? I'm on the list with the Pope. And that was just a surreal feeling.
What do you think it says about the importance of the work you've done to try and restore the voting rights of folks who've served their time, felons in Florida?
No, that's a great question. You know, So I tend to think on a much broader perspective. First and foremost, you know, I made the icon section, right? And I'm sandwiched between Michelle Obama and Lady Gaga, right? Which that is another honor in itself. But to be in the icon section, you know, I think what it says more than anything is that any one of us, right, have the ability to be an icon, to be a Time 100, that, you know, just a regular guy like me that what I think is key, made a commitment to community service, made a commitment to giving back, making our community safer, and leading that process or having that process be guided by love, right? And that so folks that's listening know that no matter what their situation is, that if they can dedicate their lives to making their community a better place, that they have an opportunity to be an icon. So first and foremost, that's what it says, you know. But when you look at, you know, what happened with Amendment 4, because I got on there because of Amendment 4, mm-hmm. Can't escape that. But I do believe that, you know, like how we won Amendment 4 was so important. That, you know, on election night, we had over 5.1 million votes, a million more than any candidate on the ballot received. And we believe that none of those votes that we got was based on hate or fear, but rather votes that were based on love, forgiveness, and redemption. And for that night, the world got to see love winning the day. And so to be able to have the victory of Amendment 4, especially in the fashion that we won that, be used as a catalyst for me being making this list, I think it's amazing. I love it because it gets to promote love. It gets to promote how we, any ordinary citizen, you know, can have an impact in their community, can have an impact in the world, could be an influencer, not by doing anything outrageous, but just simply by caring about their neighbor, caring about the fellow man, and wanting for our neighbor what we want for ourselves.
Take us back to when you got the idea to try and get this amendment up and running. How did that start?
Yeah, so there was a series of things that happened and that actually compelled me to go this direction as far as with the ballot initiative. One being in 2010, when then Governor Rick Scott was elected and he took office in 2011, the first act that he engaged in with the clemency board or with his cabinet was to roll back the clemency policies. Prior to his administration, under the Charlie Crist administration, Over 155,000 people were able to have their civil rights restored after they served their time. And when Governor Scott got into office, he rolled back those policies and made it even more difficult for a person to get their rights restored. And to just show you, you know, in the 8 years that Governor Scott's been in office, you know, around 5,000 people were able to get their rights restored. In 4 years that Charlie Crist was in office, over 155,000 people were able to get their rights restored. And the previous administration under Jeb Bush, in his 4 years, over 75,000 people were able to get their rights restored. But yet, Governor Scott in his 8 years only restored voting rights to 5,000 people. And so when he rolled back those policies, there was something that just was inherently wrong with that, you know, to think that four politicians would have the power to decide which American citizen get to vote and which American citizen don't get to vote. That was something that I don't believe that folks would really say would be, you know, that would be okay with, you know.
And to just remind us, Desmond, did you petition the Clemency Board yourself?
Yes, I did. I petitioned the Clemency Board in 2006, in August of 2006. And I was on a waiting list until 2011. And that was when Governor Scott came in office. And they sent me a letter saying, listen, I still have to wait a little longer before I can apply. And so I was removed from the waiting list. But that speaks to, you know, how there are so many people who've done their time and had applied to have their rights restored, and they've been on that list for 10, 15 years, you know, after they had completed their sentence. And so to make someone not only complete their sentence but wait an additional 15 years and still not be able to get their rights restored is a little cruel, you know. And I think that, you know, folks understood that the system was broken and something needed to be done, mm-hmm. and hence Amendment 4 was able to thrive, and folks from all walks of life, all political persuasions, came out and supported this wholeheartedly.
Well, passing the amendment is one thing, but actually getting it enacted is another, right? And speaking to you and to others, you know, around the time of the vote, there was confidence that this amendment has been written to be quote-unquote self-executing. So, you know, once voters have said yes, then it should be easy to roll out, right? But quite happened.
It is. And I think that initially we may have heard some language that would speak to the contrary, but the reality is that it is self-enacting. I mean, that what we see the legislature involved in now is trying to help facilitate that, but it's enacted. That's when the voters passed Amendment 4 in November. It triggered a process of which in January, that amendment was officially written into our state constitution. All right. And so, you know, that's like if someone was to pass an amendment that said, you know what, you have a right to wear eyeglasses, you know. At the end of the day, once that right is official, you can wear eyeglasses. Now, if the government wants to regulate when you wear eyeglasses, then they would engage in some legislative process, right? But the right to wear eyeglasses is automatically given to you, and you can put those glasses on, and nobody can do anything to you because you're operating under the color of law. You're operating under the protections that was afforded to you by the highest law in the state of Florida. And that's the position that we took with Amendment 4. That's why so many people were able to get registered. That's why I registered to vote, and I received my voter registration card. And that's why we had returning citizens in the county of Duval, in the county of Hillsborough, that were able to participate in local elections.
Do you have stats on how many folks have registered to vote, returning citizens, and have now signed up to vote again?
So we're getting ready to launch a website that's going to be tracking all of that. Right now, I wouldn't be able to tell you how many people registered to vote so far. But what I can tell you and what has been reported is that there has been a significant uptick in the number of people who register to vote.
What do you make, then, of legislation working its way through session at the moment around court fees and other financial obligations? Does that seem like a bit of a break on proceedings, or you're not too worried about that?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, first and foremost, we stand squarely on our position that there was no need for legislation, that there was already an existing standard that had been in play with the Office of Offender Review, and legislature just had to let the system work itself out and not be engaged. You know, one of the greatest nature, of a citizens initiative is the fact that it's citizens, and I think it's the second greatest form of democracy, where citizens take matters into their own hands and they say, look at elected officials, this ball has been in your corner for far too long. You've done nothing with it. We're going to do something about it. Stay out of it. Don't meddle with our affairs.
Do you think that folks who have served their sentence should have to pay all those court fees before they're allowed to vote again, or does that seem unfair to you?
No, what I believe is that once a person has completed terms of incarceration, once a person has completed terms of probation, they should be allowed to vote. I believe that monetary obligations should not hinder a person's ability to participate in this democracy. However, I also do believe that we as returning citizens, especially our organization, we embrace this concept of healing and restoration, mm-hmm. right? Because, like, we have caused harm. I have caused harm, right? And part of the restoration process is to pay that debt and to make sure that that victim is whole. And so there are some cases in which the court might order a person to pay restitution to a victim that he has harmed, right? And our philosophy is that part of saying that I have, you know, repaired my harm is to really be sensitive to the needs of the person that we harm.
There is also another piece of legislation that would make it harder. It would increase the number of folks you would need to have on a ballot for a citizen-led initiative. What are your thoughts on that?
I I know that these are harsh words, but I think it's a blatant attack against democracy. You know, any attempt to silence the voters, right, I think is an attack against democracy, because I think that this country is about we the people, and we have the bulk of the power to decide how we want to live, and we elect people to carry out those wishes. When elected officials start having a mindset that believes or says that our voice don't count, you know, our opinions don't matter, the only thing that matters is how they believe, then that's not a democracy anymore. That's leaning more towards a dictatorship, right? And that is not, I don't think that is not what this country is all about. You know, it may have been at the beginning when, you know, only landowners and white men, could have a say in how the country was ran. But we moved from that, and we've allowed women to vote. We have allowed, newly released slaves to vote, and so we have allowed people who are 18 years of age to vote. And so we are moving in the direction that expands our democracy. And any attempt to constrict it is an affront against what we believe and what we stand for. And that's what we're seeing as it relates to the legislation that seeks to make it difficult, more difficult for Floridians to take matters in their own hands.
It must be nice to take a moment and just kind of reflect on what you've done, the work in getting the amendment passed. But I also get the sense that there is still a lot of work to do.
Yeah, I haven't had time to really reflect as much as people think, you know, because, you know, if it is one thing, it's another. When we registered in January, you know, one of the things that hit me square in the chest is, wow, I think that this is an opportunity now to have to really re-engage in a conversation about civic engagement. I thought that, you know, that this is a perfect opportunity to really harness the energy of the perfect messenger. And what I mean by that is someone who has lost the right to vote and has had to fight hard and long to get it back can speak to the appreciation of the right to vote and why it's so important to vote. You know, we have over 3 million people in the state of Florida who are otherwise qualified to register to vote that are not registered. And we have probably about 3 million plus more who are registered who don't vote. And so we want to shift that culture, right? We want to engage voters far and wide from North Florida all the way to the Keys to really just talk about our experiences and you know, entice people to register to vote, but not just to register, to be educated and to actually go out and vote, to participate, to be a part of democracy. We, in January, we celebrated an expansion of democracy, and we want to continue to embrace that spirit and share it with our fellow citizens throughout the state. And so it's been nonstop, you know, so having to figure out how we're going to do that, as well as dealing with the Florida legislature. You know, it's a handful, you know. but, you know, maybe one of these days I'll get to take a vacation and really, really reflect, you know, on the impact and the significance. But what I do hold on to is the fact that people from all walks of life came together. That, especially in this political climate that we're in, to get conservatives and progressives and independents, black, white, Latino, to all come together and agree on something in a resounding fashion is nothing short of amazing, and it speaks to the power of love.
Well, Desmond Mead is the executive director of the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. He was the driving force behind the passage of Amendment 4, and he's also been named to Time Magazine's annual list of the 100 most influential people in the world. Congratulations again, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you once again, Matthew. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Still to come on Intersection, music from Vi-Electric. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You're listening to Vi-Electric performing an arrangement of Led Zeppelin's Kashmir. 90.7's Brendan Byrne talked to Vi-Electric back in June 2017.
In the studio here with me is Vi-Electric, and I'm speaking with the founder, Michelle Jones. Michelle Jones, thanks for joining us.
Thank you again for having us, Brendan. We appreciate it.
So what are we looking at here? Explain to our listeners, who do we have here in the studio?
Oh, we have a full rock band. We have quite a few. Everything is acoustic, of course, except for our keys, because we try to have as organic a sound as possible. So we have with us two violins, viola, cello, upright, bass, keys, and drums.
Okay. And can you quickly introduce us to them?
Absolutely. Well, my name is Michelle Jones. I'm violin. Then we have Lexi Parsons on the second violin.
Hello.
Then we have Caitlin Higby on the viola part.
Hello.
Camden Dumas on the cello.
Cello.
Paul Cuevas on the upright bass, who's also our principal arranger.
Hey there.
Carol Hensel on keys.
Hello.
And, of course, Bobby Del Vecchio on the drum kit.
So, Michelle, tell me, where did the inspiration come for this group? Why did you take classic rock to classical instruments?
Well, for a long time, it's no secret that rock bands have been using string instruments as part of their albums, from the Beatles to Led Zeppelin to Pink Floyd to just think of pretty much any classic rock band, you will probably have acoustic string instruments on the album. What they also usually have are guitars and vocals. Mm-hmm. We don't have any of that mm-hmm. in Vi-Electric. Everything is covered via the instrumentation, and that's where Paul Cuevas has been so generous with making sure that the voicing gets put in the proper instruments for it to go around the group.
Ever notice people walk into a club or a concert you're playing and they see you all and they don't really pay attention, they do a double take and they're like, wait a minute, is that a Zeppelin song I'm hearing?
That's exactly what happens. And then what's funny, we were at an event one time where we were doing a concert, and so we were playing, and these people, they come up during the intermission and say, well, who was your vocalist? Mm-hmm. And I said, there was no vocalist. if you heard somebody, you heard somebody singing next to you or something, but you there's no vocalist in our group. And they said, really? And that's when we realized, oh, okay. We let the audience supply it. Mm-hmm. And we found that it's twice as engaging to the brain when there's not a vocalist, because now they're going, hey, I recognize that song. And then they start engaging a part of their brain, which now makes them an active listener as opposed to a passive listener. And that's what we really love to do.
You hear some of the intricacies in the original arrangement when you play on a different instrument, right?
Definitely. When we're tearing it apart, and I do some of the arranging as well, so when I'm tearing it apart, I'm listening again for what are the key parts. Well, then what is this gorgeous harmony that's going on top of it? And, oh, wow, look at that. There's like this little flourish in the background, and we want to make sure that gets captured. And basically we're dissecting every song down to the most minute detail, mixing it up, rearranging it for our instrumentation so that everything can be played live. We do not use backing tracks. We do not use pre-recorded sounds. We do not use anything. It has to be done live and organically.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michelle, is there a song that you listen to that you have yet to transpose into the group here that you'd like to?
Oh, there's about 10 million of those, I think. So we have a list, and we keep going. But again, it takes time to dissect it and arrange it. And then it takes time, once it is arranged, for all of our musicians to memorize it, because everything we play is memorized.
Yeah, I don't see any music stands in here.
No, there's no music stands. Everything is memorized. Everything is rehearsed. And that's what also makes it different, is we don't have that barrier between us and the audience of, when you think of a string quartet, you think, oh, they're sitting, they have the music stands, and they're staring at their music. With us, no. There's no stands. There's no barrier between us and the audience. We're making eye contact with the audience. We're going out in the audience because we are wirelessly amplified. Mm-hmm. And we love getting out and dancing with the guests in the aisles, especially at shows. It's just a lot of fun. But that's the challenge behind it is making sure everything is memorized and well enough that we can interact with our guests. That we're not having to go, oh, wait, where's that verse? Oh, wait, where's that chorus? So we have to have it so well rehearsed. And right now we have approximately 6 hours of uninterrupted continuous music. Not that we play that long, but we have about that much, but we keep adding every month. We usually try to add 2 or 3 new songs.
Well, Michelle Jones is the founder of Violectric. Thank you all so much for coming in. Would you mind playing us one more song before you go?
Oh, I think you'll recognize this, and I hope you'll headbang with us too.
Thank you.
That interview first aired in June 2017, and Violectric are performing on May 4th at Kissimmee Lakefront Park. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, our intern is Ashley Garrett. Your contributions support the in-depth interviews and reporting on Central Florida that you hear on Intersection. We're 1/3 of the way to our Silent Drive goal, and we need your help. So renew your annual contribution, make an additional gift of support, or take that first step and become a sustaining member. You can do that by calling 1-800-785-2020, that's 1-800-785-2020, or by visiting WMFE.org. I'm Matthew Petty, thanks for listening.